Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I am your host, Joel Cherney. My guest today is Kyle Stevens, editor of The Oxford Handbook of Film Theory, published in 2022 by Oxford University Press. A collection of 32 essays and his overall introduction, the book takes a new look at how we view film. I talk with Kyle about how the book was developed and his process in compiling essays from many current film and cultural experts. Welcome, Kyle Stevens. Hey, Kyle, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
I am speaking with Kyle Stevens, who is the editor of the Oxford Handbook of Film Theory, published just recently, officially by Oxford University Press. Anything that starts with Oxford Handbook of has a certain cachet, shall we say. So it's interesting that you're able to put together a collection of essays which meets their standards and approval. So I'm glad we have time to talk about it.
I am too. Thank you for inviting me.
So we were talking about this just before we started. This collection obviously was originally supposed to be out quite a while ago, but the pandemic got in the way, which is not a surprise. I've had some people I've talked to about books that they actually wrote during the pandemic, so it pushed things through. But for most, it made for a bit of a delay and sometimes long, you know, other kinds of issues. So what, before we go in more detail of the book, what is your background as far as film, you know, as far as film theory and film in the first place? You actually are a professor at Appalachian State University, so in film studies. So what led you to decide film studies was something you wanted to be involved with?
Well, I guess that goes back to my undergraduate degree. I had done quite a lot of theater as a teenager, and musical theater, and was doing pretty well. And I went to University of South Carolina. I got a full scholarship there and was going to be a theater major. And it was doing well, honestly. I mean, I'll humble brag and say I was getting roles as a freshman, which was unusual. But I found that the classes, so there was a new professor. She started the same year that I was a freshman, named Susan Courtney. And she was fresh out of Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley's program, which is so great. And in her classes, you know, we were reading Freud and we were reading Marx, and it just became so much more interesting to interpret genres of texts rather than just like an individual role for me. So Susan Courtney really had a huge effect on sort of luring me away from other plans that I'd had and really just making me fascinated by film and studying film. And that changed a lot. You know, this was before YouTube, all of that stuff. So this is before even the digital turns. This is the very late 90s. So film and television still felt like the place that you could go to think about dominant culture and the circulation of ideas and values kind of in culture, sort of Frankfurt School style. I don't think that that's the case anymore. Film isn't dominant. You know, video games, TikTok, lots of things are, if anything, is dominant anymore. I mean, culture has become so fragmented. So all of that changed, but that was the original kind of draw and the original appeal. It's part of why I wanted to edit this collection and try and revitalize some sense of disciplinarity in the discipline of film studies, because it's become so spread out. We've had so many years of people keen on studying new and different things, which is great, but it just kind of leads also to a sort of flattening out, so that, you know, because everything is media now, right? So film and media studies starts to just encompass everything. And I missed when I look back at the history of film studies, history of film theory, people were having conversations and people were having, you know, debates about ideas and talking to each other. And I was really hoping that, you know, without trying to sort of go broad and do all of media, just say like, well, we can still study film, and like, how do we look forward rather than just looking back at the history of film theory? How do we start to have conversations moving forward with each other and try and get some depth back rather than just kind of breadth of studying more and new and different things? That's actually more about the book. You asked about me, didn't you?
Right. No, that's fine. It's sort of all intertwined. I mean, as I say, it's more of those issues, is that what I like to do is always find out more about the authors, since our podcasts are all book-based, you know, or the concept at least. We're starting to branch out a little bit into some more non-book, you know, some more general topic rather than being book-based. I know people like to learn more about the authors because many of our listeners are authors, either of books or writing, and a lot of them are academics. So Sure. It's the kind of thing where they get useful information to learn more about other people's journeys. And that's always one of the reasons I like starting with that. And plus, it often gives focus to whatever you're writing anyway.
Absolutely. So I went to grad school at University of Pittsburgh, which is a really great program. It was technically called the Cultural and Critical Studies program, and I really liked it because it was very much, it emphasized both history and theory, and the way that history and theory are not really separable from each other. And my advisor, Lucy Fisher, is a wonderful film scholar, and, you know, she reined me in a little bit. I wanted to do a kind of more theoretical dissertation in the end, but, you know, she was like, you know, pick an author, pick a period, pick a genre. So I picked Mike Nichols, which gave me 50 years and a lot of films to work with. So I still got to go in all the directions that I wanted to and write about sound and the close up and silence and all kinds of stuff, which was great. And those are still a lot of my interests, my interest in performance and sound and comedy. Those are all sort of there, still rooted in that book. And I'm also very much a Cavellian. I'm a fan of the work of Stanley Cavell, the Harvard philosopher who really is a philosopher of language, but he wrote about film, though I still think that he's a philosopher of language even when he's writing about film. I've always been concerned sort of with our experiences, our aesthetic experiences, our political experiences. So in a way, you know, after everyone wanted to talk about the turn to the digital in the 2000s, I felt kind of left out of the field a little bit, because I didn't think our experience of the digital image was all that different from the analog image. So I just sort of, you know, then the affect, sort of turn to affect happens. And I think phenomenology and experience is getting its due now. So I'm pleased to see that.
And your Mike Nichols book actually was your your dissertation became a book that you published through Oxford University Press, as a matter of fact. So
that's right.
That's your main book, or you? I know you have obviously a lot of writing, but is besides this new collection, that's your main book out there, right?
That's right. That's my only monograph. I'm working on two others at the moment. Chipping away at them, but.
You're not an academic unless you're not working on at least three projects at the same time. So
I suppose that's true.
But So how do you use your current, your primary focus in your everyday teaching? I mean, are you able to, in an undergrad, I'm assuming it's an undergrad program that you teach in, although it might, you know, you can correct me if needed. Do you find yourself able to use some of these concepts and some of your thoughts over the years in your teaching?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am lucky to have a lot of control over what I teach. I'm the chair of the program at App State, And really, we have a lot of majors relative to our department. We have the same number of majors and concentrators as the literature side does, but it's just the two of us, me and my colleague, Dr. Craig Fisher, which is great. He's got just this incredible memory. He's so wonderful with details, and he knows so much about experimental film and horror film and all the things that I do not know very much about. And I've got the sort of mainstream side down and the theoretical side down. So I'm teaching a film theory class right now, which is wonderful. It's one of my favorite classes to teach. Last semester, I taught a whole course on dark comedy, which was a lot of fun. I don't really like to teach my own work. I find that students don't really want to engage with it, and it's a little bit awkward for everyone. But of course, all of the ideas and my background, my tastes kind of bleed through in what I choose to teach. And I'm sure are probably more evident than I even intend in my body language to students.
So anyway, like I said before, a title like Oxford Handbook of Film Theory sounds like it is covering a pretty important topic, and obviously it is. And because it has quite a bit of academic weight to it, it's one of the reasons I purposely wanted to talk to you, because as you pointed out in the introduction, there's a lot of room for updating and refocusing the concept of film theory, and these essays that you present definitely seem to focus what you talk about right from the very beginning. Let's talk a little bit about the genesis or the background of the book itself. Obviously, as we've already pointed out, this has been long in the making. What was the original project? How did this project come about, and your involvement with it? Was it a matter that you approached? You know, where did the whole thing work out from?
Sure, sure. I do want to mention the reason that it took so long is COVID. Now, most people even sort of got their essays in kind of on time, and then some people really struggled to write amidst all of the chaos and confusion and caring for parents and caring for children. And so there were a lot of delays, and I didn't want to just, you know, cut everyone off and stuff. So yeah, it certainly was a challenge to edit a collection with this many chapters. 32 chapters.
There's 32 essays plus your introduction, which of course you couldn't finish until you had everything in
place. That's right. So it was certainly, we did lose a few people along the way, and then got, you know, new people on board. So it was a challenge. I think more challenging even than to edit a volume of this scope in non-pandemic times. So I did my first book with Oxford University Press, and then I've been a reader for them, you know, over the years. And I think Norm Hershey, who was not the editor on my first book, but who I got to know, just sort of giving feedback, you know, meeting at conferences, being a reviewer for other titles. I think, you know, we really work well together. And he asked if I had any interest in editing a handbook of my own. He suggested the Oxford Handbook of American Cinema, which was very appealing, but I immediately asked, why not the Oxford Handbook of Film Theory? That was where my heart was, because I just really felt it was time. The Society for Cinema and Media Studies conference, the sort of big film studies conference that happens every year, it's a wonderful conference, and lots of wonderful papers are given. But it's been a topic of conversation for years, that, you know, people who do TV studies think film is privileged. People who do film studies think video games are privileged. There's just like so much going on, and people don't always. That's what I meant before about sort of the what is our discipline really, you know? And so there was an Oxford Handbook of Film and Media Studies that came out maybe 10, 15 years ago. And, you know, and it's trying to include like all of those different media. And, you know, and I didn't want to have a volume that was like trying to do fandom and reception studies and video games and all these things. All of those areas are big enough to have their own handbooks now. So really, my strategy, my vision was to narrow back in and only consider film, which is kind of radical now, just to say, you know what, film is enough. Like, it, even if it's no longer the dominant cultural, you know, form of entertainment or art, it still can matter to us, and we can still have conversations about it. So that was the reason that I really wanted to do film theory, and specifically make it not film and media theory, just because that's, like I said, that's just grown so large and I think sort of unwieldy in a way. And then the sections kind of came to me really, really quickly. The only thing that changed from my initial proposal, which, you know, I knew I wanted the first section is meta theory. I knew I wanted that theory, sort of reflecting about the theory. I knew I wanted a kind of section on politics, right? Even though all of the sections involve politics, but the second section is called Film Theory's Project of Emancipation. And that's, you know, grappling with ideology critique after Trump. It's Maggie Hennefelt has a wonderful chapter on feminist film theory and laughter. Noah Eisenberg has a fantastic chapter on vernacular criticism, the history of writers who were not academics, like Parker Tyler and Lottie Eisner, who were doing amazing work and still kind of introducing theory to a wide public. The third section is on apparatus and perception. That's the one that I didn't originally foresee, but it turned out that quite a lot of us were interested in rethinking technology and thinking about what it is that newer technologies are doing. I always knew that I wanted a section on audiovisuality. So often when sound is considered, which is still all too rare, in my opinion, it's still considered separate from the image, right? And so there's still these kinds of debates. Is film a visual medium? Is it not? Like people say, you know, oh, sound matters, but then they're sort of talking about it in isolation. And I really wanted chapters that did not separate them and thought about film as an audiovisual medium. That I felt quite passionate about. The fifth section is how close is close reading? There's been a kind of move in literary studies to debate distant reading and close reading. And I thought this is actually a really helpful conversation that we could have in film studies as well. Like, what is the value of close reading these days? And how close is it? Like, how detailed do you need to be? There's several fascinating chapters in there that I can talk about if we like. And then the last chapter is the turn to experience, which deals with the turn to affect, but also several people, John David Rhodes and Scott Richman, write really, really interesting things about impersonality in film theory, and the sort of the film theorist's personal views or impersonal views. So yeah, all of that was kind of the original vision. It's essentially turned out exactly as I'd hoped, which is wonderful. And I was very grateful for Norm to give me the chance to do it.
So how did you find your contributors? I mean, I assume these days you can get contributors in a variety of different ways, and I'm sure you have a reasonably good sized circle of people you already know. And what did you do to begin the process of getting useful material that would fit within what you were looking for?
That's an interesting question. I'll take the first part of it first about how did I find people. On some level, you know, there's a sort of handful of dream people that you would like to get, right? Like people who are doing film theory that you really would like to hear more from. And so I contacted those people first, and many of them got on board. Daniel Morgan, who's chair at University of Chicago, was on board sort of immediately. And that gave me a name to drop in emails to other people, right? And you sort of like, but honestly, you know, writing a friendly but professional email is actually a skill that people struggle with. But I'll humble brag again and say that I can, or have learned to do that. And you know, to lay out your vision efficiently and clearly. And then people saw like, you know, this is gonna be a good project. This is something I'd like to be involved with. So by and large, I got the cast of performers that I was hoping for. I'm very grateful to the people who came on board early and made it clear that this was going to be a substantial project.
Going into the project, you already had a pretty good, you know, before you got to the point of working on getting contributors, you already had your overall reasonable structure in mind as to what you wanted to do. Was there anything special about that with your work with Oxford University Press, since this was supposed to be, as we pointed out, a handbook? Was there something different as to what they wanted as far as that part of it? Or is it, you know, did you find, I mean, I know I'm sure you've contributed to others, but that part of it was, I'm just wondering whether you felt the concepts that they, of what their expectations were of structure and everything else, was different from possibly a more general or, you know, another type of edited collection.
Yes. Thank you for this question, because that gets at something else that I haven't mentioned that I really cared about accomplishing with this volume, which is that I explicitly told all of the contributors, no surveys of topics. This is not, again, this is not a backward-looking volume. And it's not that we don't engage the history. Damon Ross Young has a great chapter defending psychoanalytic film theory. Malcolm Turvey revisits the idea of medium specificity in classical film theory, but for new reasons. So I think you're right that a lot of similar handbooks or companions, as they're sometimes called by other presses, can kind of be geared toward intro level kind of conversations for the uninitiated. And that is something that I wanted to avoid with this. I wanted to make sure that all of the major concepts in the history of film theory, well, at least the vast majority of the major concepts were engaged on some level, but that things were being said and argued. I really wanted arguments. Things were being argued that had not been argued before. And so there's a volume called Reinventing Film Studies, edited by Linda Williams and Christine Gledhill about 20 years ago. And that was really a model that I had in mind. I think that that's just, it's like a wonderful collection of original arguments specifically for film studies. And I don't think that we've had a volume exactly like that in the last 20 years. And so I thought it was time for something more like that.
Yeah, I sort of figured that, because obviously Oxford's reputation is dependent a lot on education. And so I'm sure the idea was that this was supposed to be, hopefully be something that educators could work with, or, and other theorists for that matter, in a certain way. So that's one of the reasons I asked that question, because I have interviewed a number of people who have edited collections on various topics and concepts. And I would think that this one would probably have a more, you know, a more focused concepts in mind, and that's why I sort of asked that. Now, obviously, as we pointed out, there's 32 essays, but you write a decent-sized introduction that sort of does some literature review, but also sort of lays out a lot of the reasons for why you felt this was important, and you sort of said a lot of that already. And a lot of it is based on the idea of change. As you point out, there have been film theory studies in the past, but it's a topic that keeps going, I think the best way I can put it, is up and down, that your feeling was, and I think you may have already said it in this point, at some point, even in our talk, the idea of refocusing, the idea of film study, and our film theory. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because there seems to, from a lot of what you talk about in the introduction, there was a lot of discussion in your mind about, okay, what's the difference between theory and philosophy? What's the, you know, why do we want to refocus and come back to discussing theory? I got the impression that you felt it was something that had gotten away to a large extent, or at least in some extent. So what was some of those things that you were thinking about when you were working on the introduction, which I'm sure you had in mind during this entire process, even until the final, once you finally knew what the essays were going to be and you could put it down in paper?
So the introduction, where I start is trying to sort of trace the origin story for film theory. And that's really, you know, remembering its place in the social justice movements of the late 60s and early 70s. When, you know, as I point out in the introduction, you know, Laura Mulvey, Peter Wallin, like people writing really amazing and influential essays were not yet academics. in fact, most people doing what we would call film theory weren't academics. They were people trying to participate in a whole social upheaval, right? And it seems to bother me, or it did bother me, it does bother me, that after, this idea that film theory sort of died in the late 90s, there was a book about, we're now in the post-theory moment. It was said, and then like the very people that you would expect to be working in the area of film theory moved over to kind of create this area of film and philosophy, or film hyphen philosophy, to think about whether or not films can do something like philosophy. And honestly, I belong to that group as well. I mean, that my first book, I think, engages a lot of that, as most of my work does. That's Cavell is a big part of that body of scholarship, and thinking about, how and whether and when do we think in images, and can movies replicate this, or, do they follow how, the work of Gilles Deleuze is a big part of this set. And I like it very much, but I was really gripped by this question of, can we distinguish philosophy and theory? Why was there never an impulse to say, or ask, can films do theory? Right? Why would the question not be raised? What is the value of theory, and why do people seem so resistant to it right now? The chapter's, the introduction title is The Very Thought of Theory. And I try sort of like, I mean that in two ways. Like, I want to get at like, what can theory think? But also this idea that like the very thought of it just sort of ruffles people's feathers. And there was a film theory study scholarly interest group for the Society of Cinema Media Studies, and it died, but the film and philosophy studies scholarly interest group thrives. And I do think that there's not ultimately a way, I think, to distinguish fully between philosophy and theory. I think it's basically ultimately sociological, but I do also think that philosophy tends toward systems. I think it tends toward thinking in terms of truth and falsity at its heart. I mean, ethics and aesthetics, perhaps not, but fundamentally it wants standards to hold itself to. That's a big part of philosophical rigor. And so I think it can constrain us, people who want to do theory in the hopes of participating in that sort of original idealistic social justice oriented kind of mindset, right? Like the philosophy doesn't exactly excel at that kind of speculative thinking, whereas theory does. And I think that maybe some reasonably common sense argued speculation is absolutely worthwhile.
Well, that's I mean, it's great that it was able to draw you in that way, because you had to find people who at least understood what you were looking for, and I'm glad that as we start talking about individual sections, that we get a better sense of your overall hope and the way it turned out. Now, you've already mentioned the section titles, but we want to go through a little bit, try to get a better sense of. You gave a little bit of a brief description of each section, but I want to briefly once again review that. And I assume the structure seemed reasonably straightforward when you put it together. You started with meta theory, which is a pretty logical place for any kind of handbook or introduction that you would start with, would be the theory of theory. What was your feeling when you... What were you looking for as far as essays for that particular section?
Well, again, I mean, I found such amazing people that part of I knew the sections, I knew that sort of general topics that I wanted, but I gave people freedom within that to select. I wasn't assigning topics, right? We were having conversations about what would be the best thing to include. And so, like, for example, I mentioned Damon Ross Young's defense of psychoanalytic film theory, which, I haven't historically been a fan of psychoanalytic film theory. So it was a really great and rewarding experience to have the editorial back and forth with him and to sort of be devil's advocate, to challenge and then be convinced. And, that was great. I knew that Daniel Morgan would write something about aesthetics and aesthetic philosophy, problems in aesthetic philosophy, but also bring it back to bear on the conversation of film theory. which he absolutely does. Brian Price is also engaging the borders of philosophy and theory, which I think is kind of appropriate in the meta-theory section, looking at what moving images can do in terms of moral philosophy. Domieta Torlasco's essay, contemplating the borders between what film, video, and essays and video essays can do, and reflecting on video essays as a form of meta theory as well. And then, as I mentioned, Malcolm Turvey has a great defense of the medium and returning this idea of medium specificity to us.
I know that's an interesting concept, because a lot of times now when you, it's gotten to a point where I don't think I've interviewed anybody related to, unless it's been devoted to a particular film. It seems like normal now that most books on the subject, film-related subjects, tends to be more, doesn't focus just on film.
That's right.
A lot of the ancillary and similar concepts, I mean, obviously film and television have a certain amount of overlap, especially these days, given the way things are put out. But film is different, and it's worthwhile reminding people of that and giving a defense to the idea that we're talking about film.
Yeah, that's something else that I get into in the introduction, and that's the part of me that's also more about language than the medium. Because as you say, I think there's no real way to distinguish between film and television anymore, and yet we still know when to use the word movie or film and when not to, right? There is something we mean by it, and that was part of what I wanted us to get at.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting as time goes on with that, because we know, especially the pandemic, definitely changed the way a lot of folks were reviewing media or watching film.
Oh, yes.
And it still hasn't changed, you know, depending, and a lot of it depends on where you live too. I'm in a small town where, you know, I'm in Ashland, Kentucky, and we have, you know, two movie theaters nearby, and they tend to show the same films, and getting to see something somewhat unusual can be tricky. And so I depend a lot on streaming and the stuff that I can access easily. And unfortunately, that often makes a difference as far as viewing.
I'm the same way entirely. I don't really love leaving the house. So it's great. I'm much happier to watch things at home under my control. And I have a lot of friends who swear by the cinema, and they, you know, are very devoted to going to the cinema. And they talk a lot about distraction and how, you know, at the cinema, you're not distracted. At home, you have distractions. And I'm just the opposite way entirely. When I feel like in my own space and I'm safe at home, I can give all of my focus to the film. In public, like I'm mad that someone's on their phone in the next row, right? And I'm like, people are like walking up and down, and I'm completely distracted in the theater. I don't understand that argument at all.
Well, and the other thing is, if you've got good, if you care enough that you have decent equipment, you know, technology and equipment,
right,
you can make it better. Because frankly, like I said before, there's one real chain movie theater near us, and it's got 10 screens, and of course it shows three movies total, so you can figure that one out, or right. Four. And it's not necessarily what I would consider be particularly good projection. The screens seem dark to me. Yeah. I've never gotten over the switch to all digital. Call me whatever you want to call me about that. But I mean, I don't like digital filming, digital projection that much in theaters, unless it's done perfectly. And a lot of places don't seem to care that much. So I can actually get a better presentation at home. But the problem is actually being able to get to the material. Obviously, mm-hmm. things are being released digitally much quicker, but outside of the theaters quicker, but it still takes time. And I hear about films, and I say, I really want to see that. I says, I wonder how long it's going to be before I get a chance to see it. I mean,
yeah, I know that feeling very well.
I mean, I'm unfortunately the title, I've been trying to get the title back into my head. It's the film Tar. Cate Blanchett's. Yeah. I really want to see that film, but I know it's
top
not going to.
Sh- too.
It, I know I'm not. It's not going to be at the theater here in Ashland, so I'm going to have to wait for it.
Soon.
I'll have to wait for it to appear someplace so that I can actually see it. But anyway, we're getting off on it, but it does talk about the media matters and so. So then,
let me say one more thing, sure. Which is that we can say that, you know, the erosion between film and television is happening and agree with it. But at the same time, like, don't we all essentially roll our eyes when people say Twin Peaks: The Return is an 18-hour movie or whatever?
I mean, like, right. Oh, yeah. It's also, like, it's I'm also sorry. Scary. There's no such thing as an 18-hour movie. You would never show it as an 18-hour movie.
Made of episodes. It's made of episodes.
Right. I mean, that's the whole idea. Because it has to be set up that way because it's shown that way. I mean, there is difference between episodic and through. And that's it. I mean, you can't. I mean, yeah, we can take a look at a film, you know, a blockbuster from back in the day, the 3-hour blockbusters like Ben-Hur and those films. But they're still one story, and it's not meant to be broken up. It's meant to be shown in its complete, in its entirety. And even if there's an intermission or even if there's breaks, it still comes down to the fact that, of course, these days it seems like the intermission has disappeared. We now see 3-hour films. And that's another reason, by the way, about going to the theaters.
That's a good point, too.
If you tell me I'm going to be a 3-hour film and I'm going to the theater, I could be in trouble. So, but I mean, it's that kind of thing where there luckily is a pretty good way that you can still differentiate. Even things that are on Netflix, you know which are films and which aren't. That's even right. though you're watching them all on quote unquote television. So
exactly.
So then, in the second section, film theories, project of emancipation. You're trying to the phrase you use in the introduction, unlearned ways of seeing and hearing movies and thinking about cinema. What was your hope with those essays?
Well, I take that phrase project of emancipation from an essay by Karen Ear called Ideology Critique 2.0. And I really like this essay. She's a brilliant literary scholar and cultural theorist. And she really, you know, Ideology Critique 2.0 is really taking a lot of scholars to task for kind of offering up arguments that they know everyone agrees with. So that in effect, they're generating propaganda, as she puts it. So, you know, writing to an academic audience now and saying, you know, don't be misogynist or something, like it's kind of like, you know, one sort of assumes a somewhat liberal readership already. And so that we need to find new ways, but it's not as though these projects are finished or completed, right? So we need to stop repeating the same ways of doing them and try and find new ways of achieving these goals for race, class, gender, sexuality, ability, et cetera. Victor Fahn, is his essay on Buddhism and film theory was, I think, it's great for getting us to think beyond the kind of typical Euro-American imperialist geographical boundaries of film theory. So that's interesting. I mentioned Maggie's essay already about the.
Yeah, I think I've interviewed Maggie three different times about three different projects. And, you know, luckily she's in the middle of a worldwide tour of the world with her with the DVD set that she and worked with a number of other scholars. So about feminists, about.
Cinema's nasty women.
Right.
Nasty women, yeah.
So I don't think she's got time to write anything else right this minute, although she'd probably tell me. She'd probably tell me she's working on 3 or 4 other things right now. But anyway.
And she'll finish them soon. She's amazing. Nico Baumbach, his essay on film theory as ideology critique after Trump and really kind of reckoning with the sharp divide in the culture wars. After Trump, and how do we move forward in that conversation? I mentioned Noah Eisenberg's chapter on vernacular criticism. And then finally in that section, Kara Keeling has a chapter about cinematic Black feminist theory, using 3 different films directed by Black filmmakers, Daughters of the Dust, Eve's Bayou, and Mississippi Damned. And that's also a really rich essay.
I think that is one of the positives of our that we now have this blown up way of sharing material, that we now are able to not only see material, like, for example, what you talked about, Victor Fahn's essay. It's easier to see some of the films because they're being released in an easier way and cheaper way, so we get a chance to see them that years and years ago we probably would never get a chance, or it'd be very difficult. But in the same way, there's also the ability for some of the folks that you talk about and some of the concepts to appear, because there's a need for them to, how do we put this, fill up space to an extent too.
And
the good thing is that, like I say, you may have to do a deep dive sometimes, but it's useful that they're there to help us better to get to things other than the most obvious fare that's out there.
I agree. And that's part of the way that theory needs history and history needs theory, right? We need to be able to see these films. It's funny that we're at a moment in film studies where the kind of most cutting edge work is being done on rediscovering films in the 1910s. You know, it's like, that's the kind of, the future is 1910. But that's, you know, like the cinema's first Nasty Women set, the work that Ali Field, Jackie Stewart, people are doing to recover Black films from the 1910s, 1920s, it's all super fascinating.
Yeah, and as you point out, that's the past, there's still so much, and probably my favorite books that I usually review or do interviews with film related are things that do have a historical bent to them, and I really like learning more about it. And even though in many cases, especially that some of these films, and you know, we're lucky if we have only a few frames or a few bits and pieces,
right.
But
right.
It helps to put the whole concept together and understanding the importance of them and the work that was done that people nowadays can look back, and even if they don't mean it, you know, they don't come right out and say, this is why, you know, this was part of my idea. It's still there as part of the history part of film.
Mm-hmm.
So then section 3, apparatus and perception. Now we're getting the next two chapters, as you pointed out, are now into the more, how do we put this, physical aspect of filmmaking and film projection. And
yeah,
that's right. An important part. I mean, it's easy to say, to just think about, you know, story and even cinematography to an extent and camera shots and such. But the concepts of that, the requirements and so apparatus. So one is more or less creation and the other is projection, for lack of a better way of putting it, or presentation. It's a combination. Those two chapters more or less talk about the two sides. And in fact, you have a essay of your own in the section 3, apparatus and perception, that you talk about headphones, cinematic listening, and the frame of the skull, which I suspect I know. I didn't get a chance to read it closely, but I suspect based on your concepts related, your talk about sound, I would think that that was your way of, you know, giving that an important view in the discussion.
Yeah, I'm excited for people to finally read this chapter, which I wrote so long ago, and is part of one of the book projects that I'm working on. But I am very interested in headphones, not so much as a technology. Like I am learning about the differences between binaural headphones and other things, but it's not about the practical aspects of headphones. Like I sort of have a kind of ideal headphone set in mind when I'm thinking about the ways that this technology changes our perception of movies. And really I'm borrowing a very old tried and true kind of method in film studies, which is, you know, how the viewer is aligned. Like people have written very, very much about the, you know, if the audience member is aligned with the camera or with a certain kind of character, right? Like that's at the heart of Laura Mulvey's essay on the male gaze. That's at the heart of Christian Metz's work. That's at the heart of, you know, Daniel Morgan's recent book. He's got a great book about camera movement and agency and our ability to kind of negotiate sort of how we see the cinematic world. So I think it matters. This kind of identification matters. And I think that the experience of going to the movies, or even, you know, if you have a home speaker system or something, the experience of having the sound be all around you and you're immersed in the sound is so very different than feeling like the sound is inside your head, right? And I think it's really interesting to to think about how that changes the medium and how it changes our experience of movies. So, you know, for example, at the beginning of The Piano, the character says, like, this is the voice of my mind, right? And if you're hearing it where you usually feel like your conscious voice is, that's a very different kind of alignment with the character than would happen in the traditional theatrical space. So I'm really interested in the ways that headphones can alter our experience of older films, so that, like, movies about subjectivity, movies like The Piano, tend to take on an even more personal quality to them. And I'm really interested in this idea that sound can occupy the space of consciousness in that sort of paradoxical way that the sound of our own conscious minds isn't a sound at all, but it is a sound. So we sort of experience it and we don't. But also I think that there are directors like Lynn Ramsey making movies today. Morvern Caller has headphones very, very centrally, but even You Were Never Really There with Joaquin Phoenix, I think the ways that she's constantly asking us to think about the sort of the skull itself and when is the skull being kind of cracked open or not, and these really, really interesting sound designs. I think that there are a lot of directors that are conscious that their films will be experienced with headphones. And also I recover tradition. I mean, sound designers use headphones, right? And the original sound designers in Hollywood wore headphones. Like it's not the original vision of movies, right? I can see a future where, because audiences talk to each other, et cetera, that even in a movie theater, you know, you might go see the big screen and then Bluetooth connects your headphones, right? So that you can control the volume. You don't hear your neighbors, et cetera, et cetera. I think headphones are absolutely fascinating. And I never thought of myself as someone interested in technology at all, but I am interested in experience and perception. And I think that that's a huge shift.
Well, and that's a lot of what you're talking about in these two sections. And one of the things I can talk about is related to it is back in the 70s, and we're talking about when, you know, mainstream Jaws and then followed by Star Wars and the blockbusters. We had directors, particularly Lucas, but other directors who became very conscious of how their films were being shown in the theaters and became much more, they cared enough, or at least they showed the interest enough that they had expectations of how their films were going to be shown. And, you know, that's where the THX sound system, not just sound system, that's THX right. system yeah, right. first came that's out right. of, the idea of trying to have a good quality, a great quality setup so that when these films were shown, they had a reasonable possibility that they were going to be similar, if not identical, to the way the directors intended them to be shown. And nowadays, that's easier said than done now, partly because of the ability to control much more in a home setting, but also things like headphones. And this goes back to something you said before about people preferring to go to the theater. Headphones will actually keep you, to me, it's my experience, they will keep you from being distracted, even if you're at home. You're not going to be looking at your phone. You're not going to be checking in on other things because the headphones just give you that immersiveness that makes it almost impossible to get distracted by something else.
That's interesting. Yeah. The moment you're talking about in the late 70s, I think that so many things can be traced back to that. The volume, so that when you're in the theater, you can feel the vibrations in your feet, or the seat even rumbles during these explosions and bass notes in the score. But also this idea that with the bigger screen, you need louder sound. The idea that like IMAX needs to be louder is something that I find, some people seem to find this intuitively correct, that the larger the screen, the louder the sound should be. I do not find this to be so. My favorite anecdote about this is Christopher Nolan requiring Dunkirk be shown when it was shown on celluloid at a certain decibel level, which was like just below the threshold of causing irreparable damage to human ears, right? And it was just so, so loud. And there's a great Vanity Fair article that veterans who were at the event said that the movie was louder than the event itself.
Well, the other problem with Christopher Nolan is, and I I think he is a visionary in many ways, but his insistence that dialogue's not that important sometimes can drive. Yes. I mean, he's one of the few directors where I could truthfully say, if I'm at home, I probably turn closed captioning on at least one viewing of a film just to make sure I didn't miss anything. And absolutely, he doesn't seem to care. I mean, it's one of those complaints people have about his film. But part of it also is, and this goes back to when you're in the theater, you're somewhat dependent on however it's set up and whether it works for your ability. Then the section, how close is close reading? And I'll be honest, close reading is something that I find particularly interesting. I've done a number of interviews with people. In fact, I just did one recently, and it should be out reasonably soon. Close reading, I think, can be incredibly interesting, to me at least. I think the concept of close reading of a film is very, very interesting, and so I'm glad that you made sure to talk about that, particularly in, as you point out in some of the essays, as they are in views of particular groups of films, and you specifically have ones about women and black films and others, where close reading, and talk a little bit about the concept and your feeling about its importance.
Oh, I think it's wildly important. I mean, I think that's, when we talk about media literacy, we can mean many, many things. But what I mean by it is that if you watch a whole film, you should be exhausted at the end of it, because you should be trying to think about every formal element in relationship to each other. And that's quite difficult to do. And so sometimes, yes, you need to go back and you need to look closely and I think generously. I think close reading is such a loving thing to do for a movie. It's not the kind of paranoid position of, is this going to offend me? It's how much meaning can I find here? Or I need to know in what way exactly it is maybe ideologically nefarious. I agree with you that it's super fascinating. That's why there's six chapters in this section that I found people really were excited about this topic. Amy Villarejo's chapter about when and where does a film begin, and how do we put films in context? She's also talking about Black films too, and the kind of knowledge that one needs to bring to certain kinds of films, right? So how do we even begin this question of close reading? What do you need to do or to have to be a good close reader? Caitlin Benson Alex's chapter is somewhat similar, Black film and post-cinematic spectatorship. Timothy Corrigan really taking up very aged questions, philosophical questions about the nature of description and thinking about that again and kind of like the work that description itself does and the critic being responsible for that. Adrian Martin's chapter is a wonderful, I'm such a fan of his chapter, Standing Up Too Close or Back Too Far, A Slanted History of Close Analysis, Close Film Analysis. He really gives so many different examples and different scales of reading that he really grapples with this question of how close is close reading very, very explicitly. It's a fascinating read. I am also a huge fan of Marketa Olirova's chapter, When Fashion Meets Cinema, where she's, you know, it's a wonderful kind of question of like, so, you know, I mean, we can think of like Rear Window or something with these clothes, you know, that it's like, is this fashion or is this a costume, right? Is it both? Is the costume sort of performing fashion? Is the fashion kind of performing costume? And she develops this concept of just sort of clothes as a third term to kind of negotiate some of this idea that these garments could be performative in some way. It's really fun.
As a matter of fact, I went back and checked the person I just interviewed, then that episode's going to be out in a few weeks based on our calendar. It's Diane Negra. She did a close reading of Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt. And we had a great discussion about so many of these concepts related to close reading. And we spent a good part of time discussing that even though the film was made during, it's Hitchcock's 1942 or 3, I don't remember now off the top of my head, but it was filmed during World War II, and it was, theoretically, that was the time period the film takes place. But it's not overt. It's not like Saboteur, where it's specifically mm-hmm. war-related. It's going on, but we don't see it clearly. And in discussing the film, we talked a little bit about how it's there. It's just not as obvious as some other films. And it just became, to me, such a great way of discussing a film in that kind of detail that I think makes close reading so interesting. And so much you can learn about film just by close reading specific mm-hmm. films. And
yeah.
And I just find the concept, to me, it's just such an important role of writing as far as film books and film writing.
I agree. It's also one of the places that, you know, pleasure happens, right? Like they can be very pleasurable to read. They can be very pleasurable to write. They're pleasurable to do in the classroom with students. And Hitchcock is so great for close reading. I mean, I often say about Hitchcock that he's more fun to interpret than to actually watch. I mean, I think one of the reasons that we all teach Hitchcock, or many of us teach Hitchcock or have historically taught Hitchcock, is because he just generates such good classroom discussion. There's a shot in Shadow of a Doubt that every time I teach it, we'll have a good 15 to 20 minute discussion on just this one single shot, right? Or the way that he alternates between realism and artifice and other movies. I mean, it's so rich to... And just invites you to sort of pick it apart closely, right?
Well, that's it. Any book on close reading, any kind of close reading article, it just wants you just want to watch the film over and over again now,
right,
afterwards, right. After both before and after. And it's just unbelievable what close reading does to help you with things like film theory and also some of the other issues. So then the last section of the book, The Turn to Experience, of course, obviously you're closing out the book, but how did you feel was the best way to, with this section dealing with ending the book?
Well, because I felt, you know, we were coming off there a great many discussions over the last several years about affect. And the turn to affect goes back a couple of decades. Ruth Lays gave us that phrase many years ago now, but it was really taking hold partly in the Deleuzian side of film and philosophy. Affect was a central concept. Eugenie Brinkema's book, The Forms of the Affects, made a huge splash. And I wanted to both kind of take account of that important moment in film theory, but also try and not rehash it again, right? And to think about, okay, so how are we going to continue to use this term affect? I didn't want to have a cognitive psychological approach in the volume, because I don't know that as theorists we're often qualified to understand the psychological side of things. But at the same time, I also saw the way that people were less anxious about the shift to digital meant sort of a return to experience rather than a return to thinking about the materiality of film. And I thought that was a way of kind of introducing more, like affording for some very, very smart people to write kind of interventions into the contemporary moment of film theory.
As I say, in going through the collection, and obviously I read some of it more so than others, but I mean, I sampled everything, but I know which parts I'm going back to for more detail and good. Which one, you know, I definitely want to continue to read some of the more of these essays. And I think in that sense, the collection definitely did its job, which was to give you places to think more on topics and more, just as importantly, new ways, which is never a bad thing when you can come up with new ways to think about something. So in that sense, but having lived with this for as long as you did, I'm sure you're glad it's out and it's done.
I am very, very, very glad. I'm very glad for it to be in the world. Absolutely.
Well, as I say, I found it to be just a great, section, you know, a great book in and of itself, and some of these essays, I can see easily using them in various, how they'd be useful in various settings. So you had indicated, now of course you've since moved on, thankfully, as you can, you know, it's time to move on, and now with things the way they are, but it sounds like you've still got a number of projects in mind going forward.
I do.
Well, I hope it doesn't take as long from now going forward. I mean,
we'll see.
Hopefully no more pandemics will help with that. So,
definitely help.
Kyle, I was very glad we were able to talk. We had to reschedule a couple things a couple times, but we were able to put it together. I really think that academics in particular, but students, people, and anybody who considers themselves to be a serious film viewer and or has shown interest will find useful material in this collection to help them better understand, particularly in the 21st century, which is what your main goal was from the very beginning, to try to talk about the modern film as we have it now. So
that's right.
I hope that you felt that the project did what you hoped it did, and I hope the reaction's been well from people who have looked at it, I don't know whether you've gotten any feedback from anyone about parts of it.
No, we're at the cutting edge here. I think it starts shipping next week.
Okay, good. Then we're right on time, which is good,
because
the pre-orders went out a month ago. So
that's right.
The good thing is now the other words, and I guess so that should be good. And anyway, thank you for joining me. I'm glad we were able to talk about it, and I hope things continue to go well for you, and that you continue to find the ways to discuss those topics that you brought up in this book going forward.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the invitation. This was wonderful.
A great thanks to Kyle Stevens for his time. This is an important collection for academic and professional aspects of 21st century film. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.